Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week.
We may not have an overall recession, we're having a rolling recession.
The economy overall looks pretty strong, at least when it comes to jobs.
The financial stories that shape our world.
Three major regional bank failures
sent shockwaves through the banking system.
We're all trying to figure out what to make of generative AI.
Through the eyes of the most influential voices.
Welcome now, Dr. Paul Krugman.
Brian Moynihan of Bank of America.
Deborah Lehr of the Paulson Institute.
Glenn Hubbard of the Columbia Business School.
Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
Inflation numbers, big mergers, IPOs, but they were all overshadowed by war in the Middle East. This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This week, Richard Haas of Centerview Partners on Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza. Special contributor Larry Summers on the controversy over Harvard's position on the war.
A statement by 30 student groups blaming all violence on Israel was a moral absurdity.
And Greg Fleming of Rockefeller Capital Management on how investors respond to geopolitical turmoil.
Investors, David, have a hard time measuring geopolitical risk.
Global Wall Street began the week trying to absorb the awful news coming out of Israel and Hamas terrorist attack on civilians and military as word came of death and destruction.
It's simply depravity in the worst imaginable way.
And the initial Israeli response, with more on the way.
Out of an understanding that there are civilians here whom are not our enemy, and we do not want to target them. We are asking them to evacuate so that we will be able to continue to strike military targets belonging to Hamas in the Gaza Strip.
Even as we kept one eye on Israel, the world of finance and business went on with a major merger in the oil industry between Exxon and Pioneer.
You have to become a diversified company.
It slots right into our existing unconventional business.
Another initial public offering came to market, this one from Birkenstock.
The first trade was at $41. This deal got priced at $46. So you're talking about an 11% decline for the open.
The critical CPI numbers came in on Thursday, the last read before the Fed's meeting next month.
The numbers come in a little bit hotter than anticipated, with CPI up 0.4. The forecast was for a 0.3 increase, but that's down from 0.6 the months before. The core comes in up 0.3, which is bang on.
In the end, the markets reacted to all the turmoil this week with surprising calm. But before we go through the markets, we begin with the big story of the week. And for that, we welcome Richard Haas, now of Centerview Partners. Until recently, Ambassador Haas served as president of the Council of Foreign Relations for almost 20 years. So, Richard, thank you so much for being here. You have a new newsletter out called Home and Away on Substack. You write today about this subject. And one of the things you warn about is if Israel, in fact, goes into Gaza, it could create more problems than it solves. Explain.
Well, don't get me wrong, David. I believe Israel should get involved in Gaza. It should go after those who undertook these heinous, barbaric acts. It's important to say that terrorists cannot act with impunity. Israel also needs to restore deterrence, rebuild its defenses, which obviously failed. But to go in really big, I do worry, would cause at least as many, if not more, problems than it would solve. You'd create a lot of sympathy for the Palestinians and for Hamas, because there would inevitably be all sorts of civilian casualties. Israel itself would take many more casualties, its military, some of them would be abducted. I worry this could become the grounds for war widening, that in Lebanon and other places, Iran using Hezbollah there would take this as something of an opportunity. I think the United States, which has been rightfully so supportive of Israel up to now, would be pressured to rethink its position, maybe call for a ceasefire. So Israel really needs to think about what it does. The good news, Israel does have options, and I would say what it ought to do is really two things. It ought to go in, but very discreetly. Where it has intelligence, go after those Hamas fighters. Could be very targeted on them. Could be from the air, could be from the ground with small units. Secondly, rebuild your defenses. They failed. Rebuild the walls. Put troops there. Increase your readiness. Don't underestimate Hamas ever again. But in Western Israel, be prepared potentially for next time, if only because you don't want there to be a next time.
Talk about the specific objective of any sort of invasion of Gaza. It's understandable that Prime Minister Netanyahu must act, as you say. What was done by Hamas is beyond inexcusable. It's just inconceivable what happened. At the same time, the Prime Minister has said he wants to eliminate Hamas. Is that a realistic objective in Gaza?
Short answer is no. It's going to be very hard to find Hamas. It's not like it's an army in an open battlefield with tanks and planes and the rest. It doesn't work that way. Also, Hamas is as much a movement or network. It's even an idea, David. So it's not just that you're going to create all sorts of resistance. Remember Donald Rumsfeld's quote when we were using drones to kill terrorists? How do we know we're not creating more future terrorists than the ones we're getting? I think that would come into play. So Hamas or some organization like it, some movement like it, will survive, might even be stronger afterwards. And as the Israelis learned in many places, in Lebanon or in Gaza historically, easier to get in than it is to get out. And when you get out, how do you know you can put something better than endures in its place? So again, Israel needs to act, but it needs to act smart. It needs to act in a really careful way.
You know Gaza. You've been to Gaza City. You know how difficult that terrain is, as it were. It's so densely populated, so many buildings. One of the objectives here is to rescue the hostages, of which we don't know how many there are, but upwards of 100 at least hostages. Is that realistic? Is it conceivable that they could go in and actually rescue the hostages?
Really hard to rescue hostages. You need totally good intelligence. Then you need total surprise. That's loading assumption on assumption. I think the more likely way the hostages get out is there's a swap. You've got hundreds of Hamas operatives in Israeli prisons, thousands of Palestinians from the West Bank who have the Israelis have charged with crimes. So I think if there's an exchange here, that would be the way it would work. Indeed, David, one of the reasons I would argue, one of the two reasons Hamas took so many hostages was one, to deter Israeli attacks, but secondly, to set up this kind of a swap.
Richard, you mentioned the possibility of expanding this conflict beyond Israel and Gaza. And obviously, this is first and foremost a humanitarian issue, a tragedy, an inconceivable tragedy. It also has potential economic ramifications, particularly if there's expansion. What about, you mentioned Lebanon, you mentioned particularly Iran, because a lot of people on Wall Street are very concerned if this goes, for example, to involve Iran, then it could really have substantial economic effects.
Well, they ought to be worried about that, and that's why, again, it's so important this not widen. I think the United States ought to let Iran know that it will be held accountable for anything that Hezbollah does. Hezbollah is not an independent entity. I think we maybe ought to get the Chinese involved. China is the principal importer of Iranian oil. If the Chinese don't want to see that oil flow interrupted by American arms, they may want to lean on Iran to rein in Hezbollah. There's things we can and should do here, because this could grow in other ways too, David. You can imagine Arab regimes around the region threatened potentially by public unrest if things get bad enough in Gaza. So, you know, in the Middle East, one of the rules of history, as bad as things get, they can always get worse. That ought to be one of our goals here. By our, I mean the United States and Israel, to manage this.
Richard, you are a career diplomat. And from what I've read of history, typically these things are resolved ultimately through some sort of agreement, not through out-and-out war and destruction of the other side. It's too early to really move forward, I'm sure, on diplomacy, but it may not be too early to think about what that might look like down the road and position ourselves.
I think you have to think about tranches or phases. We talked about one, which is a prisoner for hostage swap. I can imagine some kind of a ceasefire or a modus vivendi agreement. The big question, though, is how do you make some progress on the Palestinian issue? Wildly optimistic, ambitious, I get it. But I think what we've learned, David, is normalization between Israel and Arab governments can only go so far. It can't survive, if you will, absent or apart from the Palestinians totally. There's got to be a Palestinian dimension to this. It won't be with Hamas. They have ruled themselves out for time immemorial. But Israel needs a Palestinian partner. Israel needs a Palestinian state, not as a favor to the Palestinians, as a favor to itself. If Israel is going to remain a democratic, Jewish, secure, prosperous state, it needs a Palestinian state that's willing to coexist with it peacefully. That has to be the long-term goal of Israeli and American foreign policy and diplomacy. I know how difficult it is. I spent decades working on it. But I think what we've learned the hard way the last few days, in a vacuum where there is no hope, then if the only game in town is terrorists, terrorists will do what terrorists do. And we can't allow that to be the only game in town.
There are those who speculate, we can't know, certainly I can't know what was really on Hamas's mind, but there are those who speculate part of the triggering event here were reports about a possible arrangement with Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the United States. Even at this late date, and understanding Saudi Arabia right now has said they're going to suspend the talks about really reconciling with Israel, is there a potential constructive role for Saudi Arabia in this sort of solution you describe?
First of all, I think you're right. I think Hamas, at Iran's behest, probably wanted to interrupt normalization. Hamas also wanted to do its version of station identification. They like to portray themselves as the only Palestinian entity willing and able to take on Israel. Look, Saudi Arabia, the crown prince, MBS, wants to normalize with Israel. He can't in this setting right now. It's too volatile. The Palestinian angle's too uncertain. But, and it's important, but they still want to do it. Saudi Arabia wants the security pact with the United States. They want a nuclear program that the United States supports. So yes, I think we ought to get Saudi Arabia involved, and that could be one of the ways, again, to work with Israel, which wants normalization with Saudi Arabia. That's one of the reasons Israel might need to think more creatively about what they hold out as a possibility to Palestinians who are willing to live with it in peace.
Richard, thank you so very much for spending time with us. That is Richard Haas, now of Centerview Partners. Coming up, we go through the market reaction to a very busy week with Mona Mahajan of Edward Jones. That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
This is Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. There was plenty for the markets to digest this week, including but going beyond events in the Middle East. In the end, the S&P 500 was up almost 0.5% to end at 4328, while the NASDAQ lost almost 0.2%, while the real ups and downs really were once again over in the bond market, with the yield on the 10-year starting the week up over 4.80 and giving up over 18 basis points in a shortened trading week to end up at 4.62. Take us through what we saw. Welcome back now, Mona Mahajan. She is Edward Jones' senior investment strategist. Mona, great to have you back with us. Let's start with that bond activity. It has been pretty busy in the bond market in the last couple of weeks. Last week, we saw the yields go way up. This week, they came in. What was the cause of it, as far as you could say? How much of that was safe haven because of the geopolitical turmoil?
Yeah, thanks, David. What a harrowing week in the headlines. But to your point, markets held in there. There was a lot of resilience coming out of the broader S&P 500 in particular. And we do think part of that was driven by this flight to safety or safe haven response. So typically, when a geopolitical crisis hits, you see investors flock towards areas like the dollar, like gold, and like treasury bonds. So all three of those played out this week. But most notable for markets was the flight to treasury bonds, which pushed yields notably lower. So as you just showed in that chart, yields had been climbing almost to highs of this cycle just as of last week. And this week, they reversed that course. So that brought some much needed relief for broader equity markets. And it's interesting, even though equity markets did end up higher, where did people and where did investors hang out? Well, we really saw outperformance come from the defensive parts of the market, areas like consumer staples, like utilities, some of those interest rate sensitive parts of the market like real estate. So it wasn't necessarily a tech driven or AI rally that we've seen really in recent weeks as well. So more broadly, we'd say this move in treasury yields was partly a flight to safety response, partly maybe last week was a top for in the near term for yields. We certainly heard a couple of Fed officials this week talk about maybe a pause in the rate hiking cycle. We do think there may be some volatility ahead, especially as there's uncertainty around these auctions that are coming up. But more broadly, we think the trend over time could be stability and hopefully a move lower.
So let's talk about that, Mona, specifically. You talked about highs of the cycle and a top. What leads you to believe that maybe that's what we've seen? We also got some CPI numbers that were a little bit high this week, a little hot. We had University of Michigan sentiment coming in with increased expectations of inflation. So what makes you think that maybe we've seen the high of the cycle on the 10-year?
Yeah, it was interesting. The inflation prints were certainly mixed. We had, again, a little bit of a tick higher in headline inflation and, you know, the gradual move lower in core inflation. But even despite the mixed inflation numbers, which normally would have spooked markets and driven treasury yields higher, we saw a pretty muted response. So treasury yields were steady. Today, we actually saw another move lower. And in our view, you know, while we do think there's volatility always around the bond market, we do think the Fed and really global central banks may be looking towards a pause. The Fed has already talked about rate cuts in 2024. Now, what are some of the, you know, counters to this? Well, certainly the U.S. has incurred a lot of deficits over time, and those deficits will have to be funded. And we've seen that, you know, this week we had a 30-year yield auction. There wasn't as much demand as we had hoped. That did temporarily drive yields higher, and we saw sell-off in the market. So we may get bouts of volatility like that, but we think generally the direction of travel, especially as the Fed, you know, it's very much doing the quantitative tightening now. It's not a big buyer in the bond space, but over time, that program may stabilize as well. So we do think over time, we'll see central banks kind of coordinate in a pause and a pivot lower, which will put some downward pressure on the bond yield space.
That just what I was going to ask about is the volatility in the bond market, and particularly on the long end in the 30-year that we've seen. As you say, there aren't as many buyers because the Fed is out of the game, and there are questions about what's going on with China and Japan as well. At the same time, the supply is really, really large. Are you concerned at all about increased volatility in the bond market, or do you think it's going to settle back down? If why?
Yeah, you know, what we'd say broadly is the environment we really had that propelled a lot of these, you know, growth stocks and risk appetite over the last 10 years, you know, post-financial crisis was an environment where the Fed was closer to the zero bound and Treasury yields were in the 1.5% to 2% range. When we think about the next 10 years, it could look very different. So to your point, we don't expect the Fed to go back to the zero bound. And we do think Treasuries may remain elevated versus history. So maybe somewhere in the 3% to 4% range. So in that environment, you really do have to think about asset allocation, maybe a bit differently. You know, growth and value, or maybe a combination of both makes more sense. And certainly bonds have a better or more substantial role in your portfolio. You can now get yields. You can now get some potential for appreciation if over time we do get treasury yields moving lower. That does support investment grade and longer duration bonds as well. So what we'd say overall is while we may not stay at these elevated levels, we certainly don't expect to return to where we saw in the last decade as well.
You're also getting yield out of cash or cash equivalents like CDs and things like that. Are your clients going into CDs? Because it can be pretty attractive right now. And goodness knows it's pretty flexible. Not much risk there.
Yeah, it is certainly interesting, especially when we get these headlines and volatility, politics, geopolitics. There is this natural response, should I just hide out in these CDs? They're offering 5% plus. You know, our response is always, look, they are attractive for now. They have some interesting yields, really what we haven't seen in any time in recent history. So we understand the appeal. But for long-term investors, there's a few risks. One, reinvestment risk. So over time, those yields may not be there. They may start moving lower. So when you have to reinvest those CDs, it may be a lower rate. Two, there's an opportunity cost. And we've already seen the S&P 500 up about 12% this year, even with the volatility. And so, you know, already it's exceeded that 5% or so cash-like yield. And then thirdly, you know, we've seen historically over time, cash relative to really any other asset class has underperformed. So for long-term investors, we would certainly recommend complementing slowly some of that CD cash-like money with longer duration parts of the market with strategic asset allocations, you know, that are aligned to your goals longer term. So that's what gets you to meet or exceed your financial goals.
Quickly, at the end,
time.
Do you need to go into bonds and for fear that maybe the Fed's going to start cutting rates?
You know, we do think that there is an attractive opportunity, and really it's compelling versus any time in recent history for that longer duration part of the market in the investment grade space. And usually, historically, that period between a Fed pause and that first cut is your opportunity. Markets start pricing it in very quickly as the Fed starts signaling rate cuts ahead. So we think the months ahead could provide that window of opportunity for bond investors, really like we haven't seen in recent years. And so we do think there's a compelling opportunity for bond investors in the months ahead.
Provided we actually get to that pause. Thank you so much to Mona Mahajan of Edward Jones. Coming up, we turn to the world of real estate in a time of higher rates with Kathy Marcus, co-CEO of PGIM Real Estate.
I think sellers are having a very tough time coming to term with the new prices.
That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out Public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
Repricing the world. That's what sharply higher rates mean for just about every asset class.
Starting in the mid-60s, you had an inverse correlation between bond yields and stock prices. Then you went for about a 20-25 year period where for most of the time you had a positive correlation. We're back in negative correlation territory.
We're seeing it in stocks.
My observation over, I don't know, 40 years or so of watching equity markets is that they are keenly attuned to interest rates as a more direct transmission mechanism to equity prices, simply because interest rates are our discount rate on future cash flows.
We're seeing it in the drop-off in M&A activity as sellers come to terms with the new lower prices that buyers are willing to pay.
We're certainly beginning to see a significantly greater amount of activity. It hasn't manifested itself yet in announced transactions, but announced M&A for the first 6 months of the year was down.
And boy, are we seeing it in bonds.
We're more or less in the range for treasuries that we're going to see.
But perhaps no asset class has been hit harder by the jump in rates than real estate, and in particular, commercial real estate.
Financing is harder to get today because of concerns about real estate, and also buildings have to have strong cash flows to support the higher interest rates that are associated with financing.
Leaving investors to wonder whether now's the time to pick up some bargains or whether they'd be trying to catch a falling knife.
I think the banks in the U.S. will lose $200-$250 billion in office over time here, and there's about $2 trillion of equity in the banks. So it's like a 10% hit to U.S. banking equity. But I really think the focus on losses in U.S. commercial real estate is going to be in the office sector.
And to sort through the bargains from the falling knives in real estate, we welcome now somebody who knows the area terribly well, Kathy Marcus. She is PGIM Real Estate co-CEO and global COO. Kathy, welcome to Wall Street Week. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
So a lot's gone on with real estate, in part because of what's gone on with rates. Start with the beginning question. There's been sort of a repricing of real estate because of those higher rates. Where are we in that process?
Well, there are really two parallel repricings that are going on right now, one which has already happened and potentially overcorrected a little bit, which are the public real estate markets, the REIT market, and then the private real estate markets, which have taken much, much more time, and where we might be, call it 60 to 70% through, and that is an average, because the different sectors are behaving very, very differently. The fundamentals are very different among the different sectors, and the impact that rates have had on the valuations and the private valuation process in general is a little bit different, and the experiences have been different for the different sectors.
On the private side, are sellers having a tough time coming to terms with the new prices?
I think sellers are having a very tough time coming to term with the new prices, and the gap between where buyers and sellers think things should trade, and then overlay that with where the lenders may or may not be willing to lend. The transactions market is so muted right now. I can't actually remember a time that it's been this muted before, and it's only gotten worse since rates have spiked, really just recently.
Well, if you have to refinance in this world, it's a very different world from just 2 or 3 years ago. At what point do a lot of the sellers have to refinance and it really has to change what's going on?
Well, that will happen over time, and there are maturities that are coming up. There are maturities that have already occurred where there's been a bit of a kicking the can down the road, particularly in the office sector. So if you think about it, an office loan matures, and so what normally happens? You could refinance that office asset generally at the same or a higher loan balance, or you could sell the asset. Neither one of those things is really possible right now. The option that's available to people right now is to potentially extend the loan, and often that requires some sort of an equity pay down, which generally, particularly in the office space, is not that appealing to borrowers because in some cases they feel like they're throwing good money after bad.
So that's office space. As you suggested, there are a lot of different parts that come under real estate, and there's a big variety. Where are there some opportunities out there right now that you're interested in, particularly within the broader real estate market?
I'm really glad you mentioned that because it is definitely a common misconception that the office sector dominates the investable universe in real estate. And that's not the case. It's never been the case that it's dominated. It certainly has been higher than it is right now. But in the private markets, if allocations to office were in the high 40% range, they're now about 20%. And in the public markets, the percentage of the REIT index that is pure office is hovering somewhere around 5%. So it is far less of a sort of 800-pound gorilla than it was at one point. But I do think that gets a little bit overblown. In terms of where we see opportunity right now, the operative term is necessity. Things like housing, things like grocery-anchored retail, things like infill logistics. So the basic necessities of life, we call them sort of necessity retail, necessity properties. It's food, shelter, and your Amazon delivery. Right, the things that nobody can live without.
Talk about shelter just for a moment, because we are hearing about the possibility that it's difficult or even impossible to get insurance for some housing now. Certainly we have issues in California, we've had them in Florida. How is that affecting the marketplace?
It's impacting all kinds of property. It's not just single family homes, which is really where the headlines tend to be, but in certain markets in California, in Florida, so many insurers have pulled out of those markets because of all of the losses that they've had with climate issues over the past couple of years, to the point that you're really talking about, like, order of magnitude, about 30% increases year over year for the past couple of years in insurance coverage. So that's obviously very difficult for individual homeowners, but it's also difficult for investors.
Those of us who are based in the United States tend to be U.S.-centric in our thinking, mm-hmm. particularly when it comes to real estate.
Yes.
But there's real estate around the world. As you look around the world, do you see markets that are particular opportunities right now?
There's certainly markets where the dynamic is different, and that can create opportunity. And in particular, where I would say there's great opportunity is in Mexico in the industrial space, and particularly along the border. And you have a lot of multinational companies that are located there looking for logistics and distribution type space. And many of those leases are dollar denominated. So you have kind of the premium over a very similar, you can have an Amazon building south of the border or an Amazon building north of the border, and there's a pretty significant spread in those yields. So that I find to be very interesting, and we find that to be a very compelling investment right now. If I go to Asia, the markets are functioning much more normally in Asia than they are in the U.S. And or Europe. And while transactions activity is definitely muted there, it's not in the same scale that it is in terms of the decrease for Europe and Asia. And Europe really, the repricing there, I think, is a little bit further along than it is in the U.S., but the interest rates, obviously are really impacting the European market. The European banks are pretty much out of the market from a lending perspective, and that has, I think, imposed a little bit even more stress on that market. And we have to consider the fact that while, the rising interest rates, we've been at about a little more than a year here in the U.S. where that's had a huge impact, but Europe was, really immediately impacted by the Ukraine war. And so it's been just a longer period of distress in Europe.
I've heard it said, Kathy, that every business at this point is a tech business. I'm not sure if that's mm-hmm. right, but certainly tech is changing every business. How is it changing your business?
It's changing our business in many, many ways. And you might have seen that we recently launched an innovation lab. And that is multi-pronged in terms of having leveraging AI and data, in particular our proprietary data from our platform, in order to have better investment outcomes. But another really big and actually quite important aspect of the research and development and investment that we intend to do in technology through our lab with our university partners and with other technology companies is to address issues around climate and ESG. And it's very interesting in the real estate space because there really isn't that kind of controversy around ESG that you might find in other sectors. you know, having lower energy costs and using less water, that's just more income for you as an investor in real estate, and that's just going to improve your value. So we really have a great focus on that. And if you think about, you know, how many companies have made net zero pledges by 2050, the only way to get there is really to have technology, to use technology, most of which does not exist.
Kathy, it's great to have you on Wall Street Week. Thank you for being here. That's Kathy Marcus. She's PGM Real Estate co-CEO and global COO. Coming up, a deadly game of chess plays out in the Middle East. We go through the moves with Bloomberg senior markets editor John Authors. That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg. This is Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. The tragic war in Israel inflamed sentiments around the world, and as people very publicly chose sides, it drew some institutions into the controversy, including Harvard, which even its former president, Larry Summers, took issue with.
The statement by 30 student groups blaming all violence on Israel was a moral absurdity that appeared to reflect views at Harvard. And I thought it was very important that the Harvard administration, the Harvard leadership, made clear that those students were not speaking for the Harvard community. And at the same time, in the same way that previous leaders flew the Ukrainian flag over Harvard Yard after Putin's invasion, in the same way that Harvard stood with America after 9/11, I thought it was appropriate for there to be a strong Harvard statement condemning in the strongest possible terms Hamas terrorism. And after a couple of days without such a statement, that I expressed my view publicly, having expressed it privately before. There was an initial statement that, frankly, I wasn't very strong and didn't distance Harvard from the student groups. And now I'm glad to report that President Gay has condemned terrorism in strong terms and has distanced Harvard from the 30 student group.
Thanks to our special contributor, Larry Summers of Harvard. Our one more thought this week comes from our senior markets editor, John Authors.
At this point, I think we're fully discounting the obvious next step, which is that this will lead to a broader Israeli incursion into the Gaza Strip and what could obviously be quite an ugly land war. But the idea that that is going to have any collateral consequences or that it's going to spread into southern Lebanon, Hezbollah, Iran most significantly, at this point I would say isn't priced in by the markets at all. I'm not saying it should be priced in as 100% as a certainty, but the risks are so great that we do get that kind of escalation that I'm surprised markets are as calm as they are. If it spreads to Iran, that's the single biggest question. And once it spreads to Iran, again, it depends exactly how it does so, how far it goes. But then comparisons to the Yom Kippur War in 1973 at least become possible. You can see why the Israeli aim after the appalling things that Hamas has just done would be to eliminate Hamas. You can also see that that's going to be really difficult to do and possibly, arguably impossible to do without causing the kind of civilian casualties that other people are not going to be able to tolerate, that will create a broader disturbance across the region. I don't really see. It would be wonderful if there was some kind of a deal whereby even the Saudi Arabians felt comfortable to recognize Israel. That's conceivable, but the whole point of this exercise appears to have been to stop that from happening. Obviously, it would be really wonderful if the Israeli-Palestinian question itself could be resolved. I don't myself see how these appalling events have brought that any closer. The idea that an outcome in which both Israelis and Palestinians consider to be just and fair is further away than ever, which is a tragedy. But I just don't quite see how that kind of a positive outcome is available, how we would expect to get there from here.
That does it for this episode of Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This is Bloomberg. See you next week.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox president Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.